Welcome back, constant listener. This is our third podcast of the Far Middle. Today, we're going to be discussing the concept of what I reference in my book, The Leech, as the mothership of the leech, which is the government. Government being federal, state, local, all of the above, government in its various forms and shapes and sizes. Now, I want to say at the start that I mentioned earlier in a prior podcast that I subscribe mostly to the libertarian view of government and my political philosophical leaning. That is not to say that my view is that we don't need any government, that we can function efficiently and well as a society without government. I think we certainly do require government. But my view of what government would be in the ideal would be one of a minimal level of government to get the types of services and rules of the road, so to speak, that we need versus the version we got today, which is very much an expansive view of government, where it's prevalent everywhere you look and with respect to everything that you do. Funny, too, so taking this view of government in its best state as being sort of a necessary evil, I think it might have been Thomas Paine that originally came up with the idea with respect to the American Republic that government in its best state would be a necessary evil, but one that you need. There was also a quote from Thomas Jefferson a long time ago that in many ways just sort of summed up the whole concept of what we'll discuss through the podcast, where he said, quote, "We have more machinery of government than is necessary, too many parasites living on the labor of the industrious," end quote. I think he summarized in one sentence the views that we'll be discussing in more detail when it comes to government and creators, enablers, and servers. Now, in the book, I sort of reference the approach and views of what government is doing today and how prevalent it has become as the deep state. And I want to be clear on that, too, at the outset. When I'm referencing the deep state, I'm not using that as a descriptor of something that's hidden or secret, like conspiracy theory type of an approach, anything but. Instead, I'm using deep as a very appropriate descriptor of the reach of the tentacles of government everywhere today. So deep as in entrenched, deep as in prevalent everywhere, not deep as in hidden or secret. If you look at a recent study that was performed, it just looked at a whole range of different activities across the economy. It came to the conclusion that roughly a third, I think 30% was the specific number, of workers in today's economy need some form of government permission to earn a living. And once again, that can be local government permission, state government permission, federal government permission, but nevertheless, some form of government permission to function, to work, to go earn, which is ridiculous. And that study was published before we had the pandemic and all the lockdowns and the heavy-handedness of government that you saw cut everywhere. Again, local, state, and federal levels. So now, instead of just being able to work and needing government approval for that, we saw within the past number of months situations where your ability to walk in a park, in a public park, was controlled by government. Going to work, not whether you needed licensing or approval or regulation of what you did at work, but simply going to work was now and is increasingly subject to government approval. And strikingly, even things like attending religious services and going to the church or synagogue or mosque are things that now require effectively government approval and government regulation as to when you can go, how many people can go, where you're going to sit, what you're going to do. It really is hard to believe looking at where we've come out of pandemic with how much more government has ramped up its pervasiveness across our everyday lives. Now, this issue of government and big government being in the middle of everything and pervasive across life, this is nothing new. This predates the founding of our own country by hundreds, in instances, thousands of years. If you go and look at hieroglyphics that archaeologists have unearthed on the Nile River in Egypt, these hieroglyphics from thousands of years ago, they show everyday Egyptians making tax payments to tax collectors and regulators from government. So even back then, thousands of years ago, normal creator, enabler, and server Egyptians were lamenting their state when it came to dealing with taxes and with the government. However, the United States was supposed to be something different altogether from its inception. And you can see that with different data points from our early history in this country. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, It proclaimed pretty clearly that government existed to secure the rights of citizens. That was sort of a flip, something very different from what we had seen in terms of conventional norms prior to it. Thomas Jefferson, I'm going to quote him for a second time now on this podcast, in his inaugural address that he delivered in 1801, I think he did a really good job of succinctly defining optimal government. He said, quote, "A wise and frugal government, which shall restrain men from injuring one another, shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned," end quote. There it is in one sentence. You need government, but you want it to be minimal to protect rights, to protect men from harm. And other than that, you want government to basically stay out of the way and let creators, enablers, and servers do their thing and enjoy the fruits of their labor. If you look at the Constitution, the first words of the first section of the first article of our Constitution yield legislative powers to Congress, and that's an elected body, and it's the branch of government that's most accountable to the people because it is elected. And when you look at that section of the Constitution, what were the framers doing? They were trying to encapsulate or mirror the thoughts of someone like John Locke, who before them, say 100 years or so prior to them, was pretty adept at articulating that the legislative cannot transfer the power of making laws to any other hands, for it's a delegated power from the people. They have it and they can't pass it over to others. So this idea that the legislator has that power because they're elected by the people and they should not be allowed to delegate that or hand that over to others, that was a theory that Locke espoused, and then it was captured, I think, in our Constitution by the framers and the founding fathers. I think we've come a far way from that in modern day government, specifically federal government, as we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. So if that's what was intended early on in the formation of our country and our government, how do we get to where we are today, which is anything but that? There's probably two parts to that answer. The first part is a pretty straightforward one, which is the way we view the Constitution. When the Constitution was first created, it was designed and constructed and worded to be a very plain speaking document, very straightforward, and lays out clearly different powers, roles, responsibilities, etc. And if the Constitution didn't allow for something with respect to government being able to control something or decide something upon the citizenry, then that was something that was simply not allowed. And outside of a constitutional amendment, which would clearly articulate the new ability or power or role, then you wouldn't have gone down that path. That began to change about 100 years ago, and largely driven, that change was by the leech. And you went from what was referred to as the originalist view of reading what the Constitution says and simply following it to a evolution where you can basically interpret the Constitution any way that you would like to on a whim. And that the Constitution is not a plain speaking, pretty straightforward document that tells you what you can do and not do from a government perspective, but instead it's a very morphable, it's a malleable document that can be interpreted freely based upon what the objective is of the person reading and interpreting it. And if that objective or that reader or that interpreter is government or a bureaucrat or a politician, rest assured that can lead to some pretty expansive interpretations of a constitution that leads to much more expansive government. I also said there was a second part to this answer, which is a bit longer, and it's the last 100 years of our history. Particularly when it comes to presidents and our federal government, really starting back in the day with President Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was a progressive. He was a globalist. I think he was a bit naive. He really jump-started the deep state and the size and the presence of the federal government in a big way. He basically created the Federal Reserve. He introduced the federal income tax. He got us involved in World War I. He was a big champion of the League of Nations, which was the precursor to the United Nations, which still struggles with its legacy today. And there was also some disturbing traits that he had on the social side of things. A lot of people don't know this, but Wilson implemented racist segregation policies in the post office and the armed forces. That wasn't good for civil rights by any stretch. And he did not seem to be a big advocate of free speech, because he would imprison you if you were criticizing the government under the Sedition Act of 1918. So not a big fan of Wilson, but he definitely jump-started the federal government into becoming the behemoth that it is today. But as important as Wilson was to get things started, he paled in comparison to one of his successors, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR. And I know a lot of people love FDR, particularly my liberal friends, leftists love FDR. I don't have leftist friends. I do have liberal friends, but not a big fan of FDR. I view him as probably the most overrated president in our nation's history. And the reason I think he's overrated is I think we sort of gloss over some of the facts that that his legacy brought and instead focus on his ability and way with words, which he certainly had sitting over the Depression in World War II. I'll give him that. But if you look at some of the tangible actions that he was involved with, first, on the social front, very troubling. He did not support anti-lynching legislation in Congress at the time. That inevitably led to hate crimes and murder of African Americans. Not a good thing by any stretch. And he also, I find it interesting, a lot of people who are anti-Trump, specifically with regard to border wall construction, and I'm not a big fan of the border wall. I'm not so sure it would cure all of our ills with respect to border security or immigration. But nevertheless, those who are harsh critics of the border wall and Trump are also, in many instances, big supporters of FDR. But what was interesting was Trump was building walls or proposing to build walls as a solution, flawed or not, to keep non-citizens out of the country, whereas FDR was building walls in prisons within our country to imprison Japanese-American legal citizens and immigrants. So an interesting contrast there on if you're going to be against Trump and border walls, then I don't know how you could be supportive of FDR and what he did to Japanese-Americans during World War II. But my biggest issues with FDR were more on his approach and his philosophy. That idea, the originist view of the Constitution, it says what it says, and if you want to change that or if it doesn't grant that power, you need to then go past something like a constitutional amendment. FDR did not subscribe to that. He was sort of the originator of being able to read the Constitution any way he wanted. You saw that also with things like the whole crisis and drama around packing the Supreme Court. You saw it with what he did. So that whole idea of checks and balances of the three branches of government, that was thrown out the window with FDR when it suited him. You saw him do that when it came to sort of the role of Congress and treaties and war powers versus the president with the Neutrality Act. So Congress passes the Neutrality Act to keep us out of World War II. But FDR basically gets around that and ignores it by doing the Destroyers for Bases deal with Great Britain and imposing an oil embargo on Japan. Those things got us closer to war. And I don't want to confuse the right answer and the right outcome with getting involved in World War II. Certainly, from my perspective, it was the right call. I am definitely, though, questioning the way we got there, the way FDR tried to get us there. There's a right way to do that and a wrong way. And he basically did it in a way that trampled over the checks and balances and the three branches and roles and responsibilities of each within the Constitution. Now, FDR's best work when it comes to vastly expanding government and setting precedent to allow successors to do the same was with the New Deal, of course. The New Deal was seismic on so many fronts, but you see some common characteristics that FDR revolutionized and employed that were carried on subsequently in the decades that followed his tenure. One was using the common good as a shield. So he was a master at using a crisis or what's best for America, what's in the interest of the common good, is basically a shield to go do whatever he wanted to do with respect to usurping the constitutional roles and responsibilities laid out for government. You also saw him grab control of the money supply, using that common good as a shield, and exiting the gold standard. That's with us to this very day. The Great Depression's unemployment level, that was another convenient crisis. Rahm Emanuel saying, don't let a good crisis go to waste. He was coming way down the line, far after FDR figured that out. So FDR trouncing the Constitution's checks and balances and his quote of treating the task of getting people back to work as we would treat the emergency of a war, end quote. How often have you seen that in subsequent years? You saw that with the pandemic. You saw that with the financial crisis, right? Where we take a current problem, a current situation or crisis, and then we basically use that as an excuse to go do whatever we need to do because it's an emergency. There was a whole alphabet soup of government agencies that were created under the New Deal. The SEC, the TVA, the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, the FDIC, There was also this idea of the welfare state that was created with Social Security into our sort of a drug, right, that was injected into our veins that we've been struggling with ever since. We'll talk about the welfare state and maybe a disincentive to work, a disincentive to create value in upcoming podcasts. So FDR's biggest work, right, the masterpiece, so to speak, if you're looking at it from that perspective, was the New Deal. And it's just chock full of examples of where this idea that Wilson started, a big government, was taken to an altogether different level exponentially by FDR under cover of depression and the Great Depression and World War II. So Wilson and FDR really got the ball rolling with expansive government. But boy, they got some assists down the road after FDR had passed away, one from President Truman and then some subsequent ones from the judicial side of government, specifically the Supreme Court. President Truman in the 40s, he passed the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA, along with Congress, and that created the ability of the executive branch agencies to effectively create law without having a congressional statute to go along with it. Now, to be fair, at the time in 46, when the law was passed, it had a safety valve of a legislative veto. So the argument was, hey, what's the danger? If there's something in there that that we don't like or Congress doesn't like, it can veto it. However, in the 80s, in the early 80s, the Supreme Court, in a decision, INS v. Chadha, ironically struck down that legislative veto provision because they said it violated separation of powers. So once that legislative veto was nuked by the Supreme Court in the early 80s, this Administrative Procedure Act, the APA, it took FDR's view of executive branch overreach during times of economic and wartime crisis, so during a World War II or a Great Depression type of a situation, exception-based situation, and now it gave it legitimacy during normal times, any and all times. Now, I said that the judicial side also assisted. It wasn't just helping out with striking down a legislative veto in the APA, but also with the Chevron precedent. I think a lot of you have heard the Chevron precedent also came out in the early 80s within about a year or two of INS v. Chadha, which struck down the legislative veto. But the Chevron precedent basically gives wide deference to administrative agencies, to bureaucrats in the government when they interpret statutes, and allows the bureaucrat to issue regulations at will without being challenged from the courts if the actions are not unreasonable versus the actions being wrong. So this not unreasonable standard, that's pretty forgiving, a pretty wide standard that lets a bureaucrat have wide sway over how they're interpreting statutes that are passed by Congress. And if those statutes are vague, if it says that it leaves it up to the regulatory bodies to administer this in a fair way or an equitable way or a reasonable way, which many statutes state, then you can imagine this not unreasonable standard of Chevron that the Supreme Court has instituted. You could drive a bus through that. A bureaucrat's got free rein to do pretty much anything. By the way, a sister precedent to Chevron, many people know of Chevron, but not a lot of people are aware of a sister precedent, Auer. That precedent in the Auer decision by the Supreme Court, it sort of grants the agencies and the bureaucrats a similarly wide leeway, not with interpreting statutes like Chevron did, but with interpreting its own regulations. So there's not just one, but two precedents there to be worrisome from with the Supreme Court on the power and the flexibility that the bureaucrat enjoys. One is Chevron with interpreting statutes, and the other one is Auer with respect to interpreting the own regulations of the bureaucratic entity. So you got Wilson, who conceptualized the deep state. FDR, he fathered it, took it to a whole new level. Then you've had Congress, the Supreme Court, President Truman through the years that were giving assists and creating pathways to free the federal government and the deep state from traditional constitutional constraints. But I got to tell you, despite all those individuals and those entities and the impressive body of work that they put together, no one has done more to grow the federal government into the monster that it is today than Lyndon Baines Johnson or LBJ. And I've got a lot of mixed feelings about LBJ. On one hand, I love the guy's personality. I really liked his personal approach. I'm fascinated by him. But on the other hand, when you look at his political philosophy and you look at the policies he implemented and the results of those policies, some pretty damaging things, a pretty damaging legacy to the United States. Now, when we think of LBJ, most of us think of the Great Society Experiment and particularly the War on Poverty. And the War on Poverty had two very noble objectives. One was to reduce the actual poverty rate. That's good. And the other thing was to allow poor Americans to escape the clutches of poverty permanently. That's a good thing. Who wouldn't want those two things? But a couple of interesting points to sort of assess how the war on poverty did with respect to those two noble objectives. One, the poverty rate before the war on poverty was already dropping. I think the rate from World War II to the mid-60s, right before the war commenced, so to speak, was cut in half. It was down to about 15% in the mid-1960s. So in other words, good old creators, enablers, and servers driving economic growth and creating opportunity for the poor, that was already making steady inroads and progress with reducing poverty rate. So if you look at the war on poverty, since we implemented it, it's been over 50 years. Trillions of dollars of government expenditures and intervention with respect to the economy. What are the results? Well, the poverty rate in America today, it still is hovering in that 15% level, just like it was in the mid-1960s, even though the transfer payments to low-income families, it's exploded since the war on poverty. It's a more than a tenfold increase in real dollars. So we've seen this massive increase in spending and transfer payments, yet we say the poverty rate is still in that 15% range, right where it was when we started the war on poverty. Now, there's a couple of problems with this, and this gets to some interesting, you know, thoughts and discussions for people to have. One is that the poverty rate does only count money income. So it excludes the way the Census Bureau calculates transfer payments and poverty level and income. It excludes trillions of dollars of annual government payments to families or individuals in the form of food stamps, Medicaid, and dozens of other programs. Those aren't counted in the numbers. Now, if you put those transfer payments that are made to low-income individuals or families into the calculations, the poverty rate in the United States falls to under 3%. Okay, so it drops precipitously, which is another way of saying that the Census Bureau is overstating income equality and poverty rate meaningfully. So there's this question of the data, and why aren't we counting all income, including transfer payments, made to individuals in the poorer levels of income? That's a good question. Who would benefit from showing a higher poverty rate than what is actually there? The other problem I see it with the war on poverty is that it came with a heavy price. And that was the price of creating a disincentive to work and in a culture of dependence. Basically, if you look at how these programs are structured and how they played out over the decades, there is the disincentive to go out and to basically work or create value and more of an incentive for the status quo. And that creates a culture of dependency and dependency on government. Dependency on government is never a good thing, at least from my perspective. So if you look at this situation on the war on poverty after 50 plus years, and you think about the data and how we calculate poverty rate versus what it might be if you include all transfer payments into the income calculations, and if you think about the disincentive to work and the culture of dependence that could be created with government, who are the winners and losers when it comes to that outcome? Well, there's certainly two losers, right? One loser will be the creators, enablers, and servers that are paying trillions of dollars of their hard-earned money into government, into big government programs, into all those things to administer and sit over the war on poverty, so to speak. Another loser will be the kids and the working poor in the low-income brackets who are facing a life of government dependence, and more importantly, devastatingly from my perspective, a life of unfulfilled potential. Their potential is being stymied by these programs, by the policies, et cetera. Now, who's the winner? Well, the winner in this is the government bureaucracy and any and all of its affiliates that are feeding into it or that are aligned with it, because this false narrative of poverty rate not declining, not being able to be addressed by economic growth or transfer payments not making an impact, it's creating this false narrative that's justifying more resources, more staffing, more control, more power for government. So the victims in this case are the people in the creators, enablers, and servers classes that are paying trillions of dollars of their hard-earned income to basically feed big government and the poor and the working poor and the young poor who are seeing their potentials being derated or being capped because of this. And the winner, pretty clearly, I think, is government and the government bureaucrat and all of its affiliates and entities. President Obama brought things down the home stretch on a regulation side of things. His 8 years in office resulted in over $120 billion in new annual regulatory costs thrown on the economy. That is code, directly correlates to big government. He had that famous quote on what his views were on checks and balances across the three branches of government, right? He said, quote, "We're not just going to be waiting for legislation. I've got a pen and I've got a phone, and I can use that pen to sign executive orders and take executive actions and administrative actions," end quote. Well, he certainly wasn't kidding when you look at the body of work that he produced over those 8 years. And when you look at where the attention was focused under the Obama terms, it really hit across the three fundamental pillars of the economy: finance, healthcare, and energy. I think President Obama and the federal government got to become very astute at figuring out that you don't need to control all the sectors of the economy. If you can control and regulate finance, healthcare, and energy, because everything else feeds off of them in some way, shape, or form, then you will, by default, control everything else. So if you get those three, you got the total package. And that certainly was where the attention was really shined upon over his 8 years. And you see that with everything from things like the Paris Climate Agreement, which didn't go to Congress for approval. So there's the administrative state and presidential powers versus congressional powers at work there. The Iran nuclear deal, that was never brought to Congress for approval. So there's also some more international accords that were not brought to Congress for approval that also sort of laid waste to the checks and balances and roles and responsibilities of the three branches of the federal government under President Obama. Now, where did all this history, the 100 years, put us? Well, the numbers are startling. And the numbers are changing so quickly. They're so large, and they're going in the wrong direction so quickly that you almost have to reference your numbers with respect to the date, because surely if a couple months go by, based on the rate we're spending in this country from a government perspective, the numbers are already obsolete. But you know, looking at something like government spending as a percentage of GDP, for sure, for certain, government spending is going to exceed 50% of GDP, which is equivalent to World War II levels. We haven't seen that since World War II. On a household basis, that's over $70,000 per household, which is far above the median household income. So the government is spending more on a household basis annually than what the household income is on a median basis for a given year, which is quite troubling. Americans spent more on taxes than they have on food, healthcare, clothing, and services combined. Think about that for a minute. And there's a calculation out there. I'm not sure if you guys have seen this, but check it out. It's a calculation to figure out the day. It's called Tax Freedom Day, which is the day in a calendar year where the nation as a whole has earned enough money to pay its total annual tax bill. Now, in 2019, Tax Freedom Day fell on April 19th, which means Americans worked over 100 days into the year just to cover the nation's taxes. I'm almost afraid to calculate what Tax Freedom Day is for 2021, because with all the spending from pandemic justification, relief, et cetera, it's frightening to think where that might be for 2021. But we may want to go calculate that. I think it's going to be far past April 19th like it was for 2019. Another way to think about this, which is, I think, an intriguing one: if you looked at the United States government as a company and compared it to, say, companies in the S&P 500 index, corporations in the S&P 500, and looked at total debt to outstanding revenues, the U.S. government has a total debt to outstanding debt to revenues, a ratio of over 8.1. The S&P 500 is at a total debt outstanding to revenues of under 0.5, 0.48. So the federal government has over 16 times the leverage, the debt to revenues that your typical S&P 500 corporation does. In other words, it's a different way of saying that if the federal government were a company, you wouldn't touch that as an investment opportunity with a 10-foot pole, because it's looking like it's heading for the mountainside of insolvency pretty soon. The government bureaucracy has become quite the apt pupil when it comes to learning from the prior teachings and precedents of its predecessors. And the pandemic is a great illustration of that at work. Again, the banner of the common good and the crisis of pandemic were used as justification to embark on expenditure levels under government that we never would have contemplated or been able to envision a few short years ago. But if you take the total sum of all the expenditures in stimulus and relief packages, and you divide them by the number of taxpayers, it comes out to a very large number per taxpayer, yet the average taxpayer didn't receive anything close to that in the form of a relief check. So where did all the money go? Well, the answer, of course, is it went largely to government and its affiliates. NASA and its bureaucracy benefited from pandemic relief. The Endowment for the Arts benefited. The Endowment for the Humanities was a beneficiary. Public radio, museums and libraries, which ironically we couldn't access because government closed them, they were beneficiaries. The Social Security administrative costs, not Social Security retiree benefits, but Social Security administrative costs were funded. Salaries for the Smithsonian staff, Amtrak, the Peace Corps, the National Archives, the Forest Service, on and on the names go, and they all have one thing in common, which is they're all government entities or government affiliates. State and local governments were huge beneficiaries of the pandemic and the pandemic relief package. Through the third quarter of 2020, just to put this in perspective, which was, you know, at a pretty dark time, but through the third quarter of 2020, state and local governments produced a rare budget surplus due to the extraordinary aid provided in the CARES Act. So there's an example where during the toughest of times, with shutdowns being rampant across the country, through third quarter of 2020, states and the local governments had a budget surplus because of the CARES Act. And I think, you know, the headline number was somewhere in the neighborhood of about $350 billion in direct aid and about $130 billion in additional aid for schools and all kinds of additional money for colleges and universities and public transportation, among a host of all kinds of other things. So the biggest beneficiary of government relief was government, not surprising. And that's something that pandemic has proved once again to not just be a good illustration of this at work versus the prior 100 years, but by far the biggest example of it when you look at magnitude, which is measured in the trillions of dollars. You can also, you know, measure the size and scope, magnitude of government beyond just dollars. The American regulatory state consists of about 300,000 bureaucrats. That 300,000 bureaucrat army is larger than the armies of Mexico, Japan, France, Germany, or Israel. State and local governments, they have about 19 million additional workers. So if you take the federal, state, local governments together, 20 million army of individuals and bureaucrats, that exceeds the workers in manufacturing in this country by a ratio of 1.8 to 1. So there's almost twice as many government workers in the United States as there are workers in manufacturing in the private sector. And today, the fact and the reality is that there are not three branches of government like we've been taught. There are four. So there's executive, there's legislative, there's judicial, but there's also bureaucratic. And of the four, the two most powerful today are the executive and the bureaucratic. And I argue the bureaucratic is the one that's assumed primacy even over the executive, because the administrative state is not going to be subject to elections and term limits like the presidency is. So a president has to run for election and win election. The administrative state, once you're entrenched as a bureaucrat, you basically survive terms, elections, political leanings, et cetera. Also, looking at things like federal crimes, a pretty frightening situation we find ourselves in. There are over 300,000 federal crimes, and no one, including the government, knows the exact number. Nobody can tell you an exact number with certainty, which is interesting in its own right. And a lot of these 300,000 plus federal crimes are strict liability in nature, so guilt can be found without intent. And most are triggered by a violation of a bureaucrat-created regulation that was never passed by Congress. So it's not going to be the specific violation of an enumerated sentence or piece of language in a statute passed by Congress. When you look at that type of a situation, the magnitude of the laws, the way they can be applied, the strict liability nature of them, and not tracing back to a specific standard in a statute, you quickly come to the conclusion that no individual or business is going to be safe from the subjective whims of the federal bureaucracy. The net result of this is that when government becomes as powerful as it is in America today, in many instances, the most rational strategy for the rest of us when we look at how to deal with it is to basically fall to your knees and to submit. It was Leon Trotsky in the 1930s, a communist, who surmised this whole situation. He said, quote, "In a country where the sole employer is the state, opposition means death by slow starvation. The old principle, who does not work shall not eat, has been replaced by a new one, who does not obey shall not eat," end quote. Unfortunately, that seems to be applicable today increasingly because of the scale and tentacles of government. You also see maybe some similarities in another corner back in the 1920s of some thought, which was from Kafka and his book, The Trial, and how that applies to government and pervasiveness of the federal government today, where back again in Kafka's story, The Trial, people found themselves being charged with unnamed crimes and they were facing unnamed bureaucrats from unknown agencies. In the book, right, guilt was assumed from the start, and you had this very opaque and inefficient and complex process that you went through, and hiring a lawyer only made things worse and only complicated matters, and the system basically ended up ruining professions and businesses that fell within its grasp. The main character in the story, Joseph K., he succumbed to the bureaucrats and allowed them to basically execute him in the end. So yeah, that was a fictional story, and it was published in the 1920s. But in terms of at least the philosophy and the reality of what you're faced with, maybe not life and death in the case of the trial, but certainly this concept of a very opaque, cloudy, all-knowing, all-powerful system that has complete subjectivity that it's allowed to apply to the detriment of the creator, the enabler, or the server that is unfortunate enough to fall within its grip, that certainly paints a parallel to today. So wrapping up this podcast, when you look at the federal government and government in general, in the deep state, so to speak, what's it all about in the end? It's really all about control. It's not necessarily about growing budget or growing the staffing of bureaucratic organizations. Certainly those are tactics that the bureaucrat and the government would employ. But in the end, it's ultimately trying to exert greater control. Greater control over who or what, greater control over the individual, greater control over the economic rent, the economic fruits of the creator, the enabler, and the server. That's what this is really all about in the end. And today's bureaucratic monster or monsters that are out there have learned quite well from the past prior 100 years of precedent that we discussed. You see it everywhere. You see it with very positive and creative packaging, but then a pretty ugly reality just underneath. So if you look at something like the Green New Deal, you got New Deal in there, green, saving the environment, saving the planet. Who would be against that? But the reality of the Green New Deal, when you look into the details, is about exerting massive amounts of control on an unprecedented basis across every man, woman, and child in the United States in all kinds of different and incredibly diverse ways. So that is a quite dangerous proposition. You see it, we talked about pandemic and pandemic relief packages. Who were the biggest beneficiaries of pandemic relief under the quote-unquote health crisis and providing relief to Americans hit hard by the pandemic, right? Who would be against that? Yet the details show that your typical American or taxpayer was not the primary beneficiary of all of this spending and relief programs. It was government and government entities or affiliates. And then you even see it beyond the United States. There are parallels in places like the EU, where in many ways we are following the EU, following their lead on this. They're a bit ahead of us, and you can see what quality of life is like in the EU and their economic growth prospects. It's not that bright compared to what we've got, so I'm not sure why we want to follow that example. But the EU's antitrust chief, she's gone on record of her desire to impose what she calls a special responsibility on dominant companies not to abuse their power through regulation. Now, what that special responsibility is, or what constitutes a dominant company, or what abuse of power would look like, that is undefined, that's purely subjective, and that's perfect because that gets to be decided exclusively by the bureaucrat and by the government. which again is all about control. So keep that concept about control in your head whenever you see different government programs labeled under a really shiny, positive sounding message. What's it really all about in the end? I think more often than not, you will land on the topic of control. Well, that wraps up this installment of our Far Middle podcast, and I look forward to speaking to you in short time again on another exciting topic. Until then, take care and stay safe.